KD2CKD, K2RIW, how copy?
Take check in, N2EO.
We got you, Rich. KD2CKD, are you there? K2RIW?
K2LIW, KD2CKD, handle is Josh, and it was N2EO as well. Westchester County, my white plane, say hello.
Very fine, Josh. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, K2RIW, and I was asking you, are you checking into the TechNet, which is going to start in a couple of minutes? Over to you, Josh.
K2RIW. I didn't realize that. Thanks for the heads up. I'm just taking a quick ride and thought I'd hear, listen who's on. So I guess I'm going to get to hear the net in a few minutes. Go ahead.
W8YY checking in.
WD2GXM checking in.
Okay, we got RYY and GXM. And Josh, try to think up a question for the TechNet. Because being a holiday weekend, we might have very few people today. Although, right now, it looks like we do have people signing in. Glad to see. So, see if you can think up a question, Josh. And in roughly 1 minute, the TechNet begins. K2RIW standing by.
The Earth is flat.
Tonight at 8 o'clock, this is the W2VL repeater net time.
Okay. First person, if he has a question, is Josh, KD2CKD, K2RAW. Go ahead, Josh, just in case you got a question.
Okay, K2RAW, KD2CKD. My time is very limited. I have to get my destination soon, but sure. I have been trying to make a decision on getting a wire antenna up, and I've been trying to figure out if I should go with a traditional center-fed dipole, or should I try one of these that are end-loaded, end-fed, rather. I'm just not sure. I can't quite tell what the main differences are. Go ahead.
There is no great advantage of one over the other, Josh. In other words, properly fed, each will give you the same performance. And believe it or not, one of the things that very few people know is even if you make the antenna physically small, make it compact by using a helical winding, loading coils, zigzagging it, top hat capacitors on the end of the antenna, whatever, even if you make the antenna small, as long as it resonates on your frequency and gives you a reasonable impedance match, no matter how you feed energy into it, you'll get the exact same performance, the exact same pattern, the exact same gain. So whether you feed it in the center or the end, the center is more traditional and it's a little bit easier mechanically to set up. Feeding from the end, because when you feed the dipole, a half-wave dipole from the end, instead of seeing a 70 ohm impedance antenna, you see a 2000 ohm antenna, and it requires an extra network of some kind to adjust for that impedance. So in order to get on the air in a hurry and have the least amount of grief, I recommend you take a center-fed dipole. That's my recommendation. But if you're willing to go through the rigmarole of end feeding, it'll work extremely well. And once you've decided to use impedance matching networks, in either case, you can use that antenna over a rather wide frequency region and maybe even on multiple bands. I know that's not a simple answer, but it's not a simple question. Over to you, Josh. KD2, Charlie, Quebec, Charlie, Kilo, Delta, K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. You got it, Josh. My name is Dick.
Very good, Dick. KTRIW, KD2, CKD. No, that wasn't bad. There's a number of things to consider. I was attracted to feeding it off-center. I thought that the physical configuration of my yard against the house and all that, that would be useful, and I was shy because I was trying to figure out what the compromise would be. My instincts told me that the center fed would be the fastest way to get from point A to point B as far as making it work properly, but yeah, I'm going to read a little more about it. Sounds like I can end up with just about the same performance, so thank you very much. Appreciate it. KD2CKD.
Yeah, once you accept the fact of using some kind of impedance matching network, an antenna matcher, or what are you going to call it now, a loading network, I can't even think of the name of the darn things, but you know what I mean. An amazing number of antennas have impedance matching networks connected to them, antenna tuner. All the antennas inside your cell phone don't resonate on all of those frequencies, right alongside of the antenna, right on the printed circuit board of your cell phone, with that internal antenna, is an impedance matching network. There's an antenna tuner in every one of those antenna, every one of those cell phones. That's what makes the antennas work on so many frequencies and such wide frequency regions. And the main thing the antenna tuner does is to resonate the antenna. The most important seven words in the English language, if you're an antenna designer, is you resonate first, then it will radiate. Once the antenna resonates and has a reasonable impedance match, whether the antenna is small, big, zigzagged, whatever, you'll get the exact same performance, and it'll act like a full-size half-wave dipole. Lots of people think that when you shrink it mechanically, you're going to lose a lot of performance, not necessarily. Off-center fed, there's various ways of slightly or very largely off-center fed. In the last month or two in QST magazine, there were some articles on offset fed dipoles, which, let me drop. Offset fed dipoles with the right kind of a network, a balancing device, maybe a 4-to-1, a 9-to-1 balance, and maybe a poor man's balance also, you know, with multiple coils of the transmission line taped together near the antenna to make sure there's no current flowing down the outside of the transmission line. With these techniques, there's lots of different ways you can feed that dipole. 10% off-center, 50%, 80% off-center, the very end, or the center. And when set up properly, they all work, and some of them have other advantages. Now, one other good thing you should know, Josh, and that is a wire dipole does not use expensive materials, not counting the balancing device or the antenna tuner. The antenna itself is cheap. So to get on the air, build one with center feeding to be nice and simple and be on the air. Then build others. Maybe set up one for east-west and one for north-south. Set up more than one dipole. I mean, the wire is cheap, and so and there's great advantages having multiple antennas. Sometimes you flip to the other antenna, and the guy you want to talk to is a hell of a lot stronger on that particular band, on that particular band condition of that particular day. KD2, CKD, K2RIW. You got it, Josh.
KX, I want to comment.
Go ahead. You got it, Rich.
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM. You should consider, I think your mounting options will in some part determine whether you put up a center-fed dipole or an end-fed wire, because you're going to have to get the transmission line up to the center of the dipole somehow. If it's more convenient to route the transmission line to the ground and set up an end-fed wire, that would be a consideration. WP2GXN.
Yeah, when it comes to mounting arrangements, quite often people have one high center-fed object, like the roof of the house or a tree. And so the center is raised high and the ends are down, so it's an inverted V dipole. And that makes very little change in the tuning. Also, the transmission line, everyone believes the transmission line must come off the center of the dipole exactly at right angles. Not true. You can have it come off from the center of the dipole at a very steep angle, almost parallel to one of those wires. And as long as you're not unlucky where the transmission line happens to be a resonant lens, coming off at a crazy angle still works. And particularly if you're using an antenna tuner, you can get away with murder. So you can still feed it in the center, even though the center is an inconvenient place. So there's lots and lots of ways of doing it. But the antenna itself is inexpensive enough, so after you put up the first one and you're on the air, consider building other ones, Josh. KD2CKD. You're allowed to come back and ask lots of questions on this. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And comment again to you.
Yeah, stand by. Let's let Josh say a couple of words here first. Go ahead, Josh.
Thanks very much, Dick. I'm actually at my destination. Wow, that is a lot of information. One thing I really appreciate, though, that you mentioned about keeping it simple at first and having multiple antennas, that would be a very, very good idea, because let me have something that I can use as my benchmark, right? And then as I try to develop the, more end-fed or off-center fed, then I'll have something to compare to, switch back and forth if I lose my confidence, stuff like that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I like your attitude on all this, Josh. The main thing we ham radio operators do is that we are very good hands-on antenna experimenters. You want an antenna expert, you're going to hire a ham radio operator. Because even the people who take highfalutin courses in college on antennas, you'd be amazed how much antenna knowledge they wish they had. They always need more of it. So you're going to get a lot of hands-on experience. You'll find out things that work and don't work. And even if it doesn't work, it's not going to catch on fire. It's not going to explode. With rare exception, it's not going to damage any of your equipment. Most modern-day transmitters are pretty rugged. So go ahead and put up multiple antennas and start comparing the results between them. Even consider a switching network so that while you're listening, you can flip to antenna A and antenna B and antenna C and transmit them back to it. And by the way, consider a sloping dipole also. I mean, one end can be near the ground, the other one can be wherever your high support is. A sloping dipole can also work very well, where now you have a little bit of both horizontal and vertical polarization. And the guy you're talking to, he may be using a horizontal antenna, and you're using a horizontal antenna, and you think there's no problem with polarization. That signal on HF frequencies going through the ionosphere is looking at a plasma we call the ionosphere. Let me drop. It's also looking at the Earth's magnetic field that's mixed with it. So a plasma with a magnetic field does something very interesting to a radio wave. It does something called Faraday rotation of polarization. So you may issue a horizontal signal, and by the time it gets through that ionosphere, it arrives in New England, where in England, the guy you're talking to, vertically polarized. And the guy in England, he sends you back a vertically polarized signal, and it may end up vertically polarized at your shack. Faraday rotation doesn't obey reciprocity. The signal going from east to west twists a certain number of times. The signal going from west to east twists some other number of times. So now you see some of the advantage of having multiple antennas and flip between the two, and you may find out that transmitting antenna number one gives him the best signal, but listening on signal number two gives you the best signal. You'd be amazed the craziness of high-frequency propagation through the ionosphere with multiple antennas and some crazy experiments you can do with that. So looking forward to hearing from you when you start doing some of these things, Josh. KD2CKD, about to sign off. K2RIW, go ahead, Josh.
Question.
Josh first. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, I got to go. Thanks. K2RIW and Ned, KD2CKD. Thank you very much. All of you for all of your comments, and I have not heard about that polarization shift effect before, so that's pretty awesome. Thank you for sharing that with me. I'll try to read up on that a little bit as well. I used to monitor you guys more when I was in Brooklyn. I just moved up to the top of Westchester County. Not as easy to get you guys, but I can hear you. Just can't really hit the repeater all the time. Anyway, have a great evening. 73 is all, and wish me luck, and we'll speak again. KD2CKD signing off.
Yeah, very fine, Josh. When you're listening to an HF signal, sometimes you'll hear the signal go into a phase, and you think the signal is skipping over you in phase. Well, sometimes it's rotating in polarization. Faraday rotation. Michael Faraday is the guy that's accredited with this Faraday polarization rotation. Ionosphere plus magnetic field, plasma plus magnetic field. All right, we got two people standing by. Rich wants to make a comment, and somebody else has got a question. Yeah, we got a question. Rich first. N2EO, been standing by. K2RIW. Go ahead with your comment, Rich.
Okay, Dick. As you know, I don't recommend coax on a random wire antenna. The impedance is not 50 ohms, and coax on an open, on a non-resonant antenna will provide a very, very high loss. The best thing to use to the tuner is open wire line to a 4-to-1 balun, and then the short jumper from the balun made out of coax to the antenna tuner. That's it, Dick.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Rich. Any long length of transmission line, coax cable, for instance, with a high standing wave ratio, does give you a lot of extra loss of signal. Unless you use the transmission line up to the antenna, and then the impedance matching device is at the antenna. In that one case, you can get away with feeding an NFED dipole right with no loss, per se, with coax cable, if the impedance match is at the antenna, which brings the crazy 2,000 ohm impedance of an NFED dipole down to 50 ohms or 70 ohms, and then the transmission line right at the antenna, and that impedance matching network takes over for the rest of the distance in the shack. If you've got to have a high standing wave ratio on the transmission line, Rich is absolutely right. It's got to be open wire line, super low loss. You can get away with that. And the person who said question didn't tell us who he was. He didn't tell us it was Wes. He didn't tell us it was N2XJN. And I made a guess by his voice, a very distinctive voice. Over to you with your question, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, N2XJN. Polarization, Faraday rotation. Still plane polarized, but the plane of polarization is rotated by an angle proportional to the field density. My question to you, is it frequency dependent?
Yeah, good question, Wes. It's very frequency dependent. The amount of rotation you get is a function of 1 over frequency squared. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the amount of rotation becomes less and less. When you're down at the low frequencies, 20 meters, 40 meters, 80 meters, you can get a lot of rotation, maybe multiple turns of rotation. And you said the word linear polarization. You're starting off with linear. The Faraday rotation of the ionosphere is rotating the polarization to some other angle for the main signal going through the ionosphere. You might have more than one bounce going on. There may be some other signal by some other path getting there at the same time. Therefore, even though you're transmitting pure linear polarization, what the guy receives on the other end could easily be elliptical or circular polarization. Whenever you mix two signals, like say, for instance, if one of the paths with the rotation makes the signal arrive horizontal at the other guy's end, at his end, and the second path of bouncing gives him some vertical signal, and depending on the time delay between the two, the phase shift between the two, horizontal and vertical arriving simultaneously could give him circular polarization. Depending on what kind of antenna he's using, he could be getting more signal if he had a circular polarized antenna. And then you got to worry about clockwise versus counterclockwise. Very few situations does a pure linear transmitting signal result in a pure linear signal received at the other end. There's almost always a little bit of elliptical polarization. Even the way you feed a Yagi antenna. The Yagi antenna might have 95% of its signal horizontal because the Yagi is horizontal. But there's always going to be a little bit of vertical polarization coming out of that driven element of that dipole, depending on how you feed it. So very few situations are pure in polarization. But Faraday rotation is a very dominant effect that isn't often mentioned. Very few people know about it. It's a well-kept secret. N2XJN, K2RIW, you got it, Wes.
I have two things more. Thank you very much. Great. I do very much. Thank you for that. Polarization of cyclotron radiation from plasma. We know that ionosphere is plasma as well. In uniform magnetic field, now we could say about the Earth magnetic field, is to be compared, the synchrotron is to be compared to Earth ionosphere waveguide. Could you make that comparison?
You've often talked about the ionosphere and the Earth as a Earth waveguide. And to a degree it is. The signal, when it makes multiple bounces to get from here to Europe, we'll say, it can be hitting the ionosphere multiple times because of the curvature and maybe never hits the Earth in between. But quite often, it will hit the ionosphere, bounce at a certain angle, come down and bounce off the Earth, and then bounce back up and hit the ionosphere. So does it always act like a piece of waveguide? Not necessarily. So there's all kinds of ways it can happen, depending on the frequency, the amount of ionization of the ionosphere, the angle of bounce you get off the ionosphere is not always the same angle, although it is, in general, a grazing angle, a very shallow angle. You draw a scale model of the ionosphere, which is like, 60 kilometers above the Earth is one of the typical numbers, or 100 kilometers. But the Earth is a 6,000 kilometers of radius. So if you made a scale model of the ionosphere and you drew it on top of a spherical Earth, you'd be amazed how close that is. Or the International Space Station, you think it's way out there in space. It's very close. As a scale model, it's very close to the Earth itself. So the way the signal bounces is you could call it waveguide between Earth and ionosphere if you want to. But it's one of those surfaces. A real piece of waveguide is two very highly conductive surfaces minimum, usually four of them. It's a rectangular device, and the signals are bouncing off very highly conductive. Well, the ionosphere is not highly conductive. We call it a bounce of the ionosphere. It's really a wave-bending phenomenon for the signal that goes into the ionosphere. It's not a pure bounce. So life's a little bit more complicated. And over to you, Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you for that. Magnetically induced defringence, if I properly pronounce it, is called Faraday defringence. But it's phase sensitive. So Faraday rotation is phase sensitive. A few words about it.
What I think you're really saying is the elliptical polarization you get. How elliptical, how circular, clockwise versus counterclockwise, that's all very time delay, phase sensitive. Time delay and phase shift are really pretty much the same thing. So that bounce you get off the ionosphere is a little bit different in timing. Not a pure bounce, it's sort of a wave bending phenomenon, and a wave twisting in polarization going on at the same time. So, and what you get at the far end, how elliptical, how much horizontal, how much vertical, what phase shift between the two, what phase angle between the two, that's what determines circular versus linear. If you want to generate pure linear polarization, one way to do it would be to have a horizontally polarized dipole, a vertically polarized dipole, for a horizontally polarized Yagi, and a vertically polarized Yagi, where all those elements are all going through the exact same boom, horizontal elements and vertical elements on that boom, and horizontal and vertical driven element. And now, depending on how you feed the horizontal and vertical driven element, are they located? How physically displaced are they? That gives you some time shift and phase shift. And how displaced in time or phase is the signals going to those driven elements? But if you arrange it in such a way that what the signal that eventually radiated by your crossed polarized set of Yagis, all on one boom. Let me drop. If with the physical shift of the elements in position and the time and phase shift of the way you feed them, if you set it up just right so that the signal radiated by the front of the Yagi has horizontal and vertical signals, horizontal signals, vertical signals, equal in amplitude, and if the final signal radiated is exactly 90 degrees in phase shift between the horizontal and vertical, under that condition, you have now transmitted pure circular polarization. And depending on whether the horizontal or the vertical is the delayed one or the advanced one, determines whether or not the signal, circular polarized signal, is clockwise versus counterclockwise. So polarization and elliptical and circular polarization, you can do months of study on all the ways of evaluating and generating those signals. I've just given you one possible way of doing it. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you for that. If you have a transmitter, and then you have open transmission line, at the end of the transmission line, you have nothing, or you have it short, it doesn't matter, it's going to be the same effect. Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe so. Now you have a standing wave. So the energy is bouncing back and forth, and if we try to develop any means by SWR matching, so we're not talking about 1-to-1, but 1-to-5, 2-to-5, 5-to-5, good. Okay, we have a 20% matching. Now, does it mean that 20% of the energy from the transmitter, because we have a 20% of matching, instead of 50 ohm resistor, we have a 20 ohm resistor. Is 20% of that matching going to be dissipated on the load?
From your description, there is no load. You said the end of an open wire transmission line is either shorted or open.
What I'm saying is, yes, we have a shorted one or open, then we have a standing wave. But now, the next step what we do is, we deliver instead of 50 ohm load, whether that would be antenna or that would be a purely resistive load. We're delivering 20% of impedance match, not 50. Does it mean that 20% of the energy that is trapped into the standing wave would be released from the standing wave and 10% will still be bouncing?
From an energy point of view, a short circuit or an open circuit at the end of the transmission line reflects all the power, but not the same way. An open circuit reflects the signal with no phase shift, but all the signal gets reflected. A short circuit reflects all the signal with a 180-degree phase shift. You get an in-phase signal going out and an out-of-phase signal coming back with a short circuit. So the nature of the standing wave and the impedance you see at the transmitting end is very different with a short at the far end versus an open at the far end, even though both might have the exact same standing wave ratio. A different standing wave. And now when you have an impedance mismatch, because most transmitters might give you best performance with a 50 ohm load, that doesn't mean the transmitter is a 50 ohm impedance transmitter. Very few transmitters that give best performance with a 50 ohm load, very few transmitters really are 50 ohms. A transistor is a current generating device. A current generating device is very close to an open circuit. A tetrode tube is primarily a current generating device. Impedance wise, it's nearly an open circuit. So of the signal that gets reflected back to the transmitter is such a poor match, it doesn't absorb much of it, a little bit of it. An awful lot of it gets re-reflected forward, in phase and out of phase. Mostly in phase because it's very close to an open circuit. Because the signal is now bouncing back and forth on that transmission line, whatever the loss of the transmission line is, You're now multiplying that loss. You get some loss on the first time the signal goes forward. You get some loss when the signal comes back as the first reflection, and so on. Most of the loss of that network is loss by heating of the transmission line. So that's where the power gets wasted. You want to know where's the power going. When you have a high standing wave ratio, a poorly matched antenna, and the antenna is only absorbing 20% of the power, where's the other 80% going? Most of the time, that 80% is dissipated by the losses of the transmission line, and you would think the transmission line now has nowhere near that amount of loss. It does have that amount of loss because you're using that loss multiple times. All those bounces of signal forward and reverse, each bounce is getting some of that loss. So of the signal not absorbed by the antenna, the load, majority of it is lost by heating of the transmission line. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Thank you for that. So I'm going to rephrase it. We have a standing wave, and there is impedance mismatch. We deliver now purely resistive load. Transmitter is 50 ohm. The line is 50 ohm. The load is 20 ohms. Should we understand that standing wave could dissipate those 20% on the load and 30% would be other losses, if any?
Okay, you said the transmitter is 50 ohms. Almost no transmitter that you and I can use and put our hands on and buy is anywhere near a 50 ohm source. It gives best performance when loaded with 50 ohms. It is not a 50 ohm source. It's very close to an open circuit. It's a very high impedance source. It's a current generator. Most of the transmitters that we can touch with transistors and tubes are very close to an open circuit. So you're going to get a lot of bouncing of signal. The only way you could make the transmitter guaranteed to be a 50 ohm source is if the transmitter went through, let me pick a number, a 10 decibel attenuator, which is set up as a 50 ohm attenuator. When you take your nearly open circuit transmitter impedance as a transmitter, put it through an attenuator, because the attenuator is made out of 50 ohm resistors, you can now come to a very close to a 50 ohm source impedance at the far end of the attenuator. That's the good news. Now you've got nowhere near as much power. Start off with a 100 watt transmitter, put it through a 10 dB resistive attenuator, you've only got 10 watts left, but it's now very close to 50 ohms. So you can force a 50 ohm source impedance if you're willing to tolerate a lot of insertion loss. There are other ways of doing it. You could put a very elaborate antenna tuning network at the transmitter to force it to be a 50 ohm output impedance. Not easy, because you're starting off with a nearly open circuit source impedance of the transmitter. But whatever you end up with as the final source impedance at the transmitting end and the final load impedance at the antenna end, and now you have a calculated amount of standing wave ratio, when you put that all together, very few of us calculate standing wave ratio using the source impedance with the load impedance. Both of them are not 50 ohms. So the real calculated standing wave ratio is almost always quite a bit higher than you think. Only when the load is perfectly matched, a pure 50 ohm. Let me drop. Only when the load is a pure 50 ohm source, a 50 ohm load, a perfect 50 ohm resistive antenna. Now all the signal that your transmitter launches into your 50 ohm transmission line, all of that signal goes down the transmission line only once, and then, in theory, 100% of it is absorbed by that 50 ohm antenna and radiated, and nothing is reflected. That's the ideal case. You start developing some standing wave ratio because the antenna is a mismatch. Now you're getting a compound mismatch both at the load impedance end and the source impedance end. It's kind of hard to believe that the signal only flows down there once, even though you might have a 1,000 ohm impedance source for the transmitter, and that might be real. It's at least going to be more than hundreds of ohms, most transmitters are, source impedance, but once it launches that signal under the 50-ohm line, of the signal that it can radiate down that line, which might be 100 watts, all of it can be absorbed and radiated by the antenna, if and only if the antenna represents a pure 50-ohm resistor. So real standing wave ratio gets complicated very fast when the antenna is a mismatch. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. Great. That's a great answer. And I do thank you for that. Just one last thing from purely theoretical standpoint. In purely resistive load, and we do have in our houses, in our rigs, we have a purely resistive load. The amount of energy that is dissipated on that load equals the percentage of impedance match. That means if we're talking about standing wave and 20% of that energy is dissipated into the purely resistive load, assuming theoretically that we don't have a losses on the transmission line. So our SWR is actually, could be actually pictured by the percentage of energy dissipated on the load. So we're actually stealing from the standing wave the energy till we actually get the full match of that energy with the load. That's what I said.
What you said has got some merit, Wes, but it almost never happens. If you and I use reasonable materials to build the antenna, 14-gauge copper wire, or half-inch diameter aluminum rods for the driven element of a Dagi, for instance, and so on. As long as you and I use reasonable materials for the antenna, the resistive loss of the antenna is very low. The reasonable materials you and I use are very high in conductivity. Therefore, you're worried about extra losses in the antenna due to standing wave ratio, mismatch, resistive, and so on. No. The antenna itself is a highly conductive object if you've used reasonable materials. How much power is absorbed and reflected is strictly a function of the impedance mismatch. And if you calculate that because you've got a 5.6 to 1 standing wave ratio at the antenna, which means only 50% of the power is absorbed on the first pass. Of the 50% that is reflected, it is reflected with 50% of loss, 50% radiated on the first pass, and if the transmitter was a pure 50-ohm load, all the reflected power would be absorbed, and a 50-ohm source, all the reflected power would be absorbed, and there wouldn't be multiple bounces, and of the so-called loss in that system, that loss would be, back at the transmitter, if it's a 50-ohm transmitter. So, the books will often talk about ohmic loss of the antenna versus radiation loss. With any reasonable antenna you and I really build, the impedance that you see, the resistive component of the impedance, is the radiation component, not the loss component. Every real antenna, unless you build it out of a nichrome wire, and have distributed resistors in it, and coated it with carbon granules, unless you've done something really weird to the antenna, most antennas have very little resistive loss. You can prove that by putting 10 watts into the antenna for 10 minutes, turn off the transmitter, and touch the antenna. If it's ice cold, it has no resistive loss. Almost all the antennas you and I build, you put power into them for a couple of minutes, turn it off and touch the antenna, everything's ice cold. You cannot get resistive loss in an antenna without it getting hot. That's, resistive loss dissipates its energy by creating heat. If the antenna runs ice cold, it has no resistive loss. N2XJN, K2RIW.
I do agree with this, and I do understand that. I was getting a lot of my young years with simply tuning a amplifier to the load that was the incandescent light bulb. Just for fun. And also when I was tuning it, and when I was working, when I was building amplifiers. Let me jump. So let's assume that we don't have an antenna. Let's assume that we have a tungsten wire inside of incandescent light bulb as a load. The percentage of the energy dissipated on that load gives us possibly a light, but that depends on the frequency also, which is the heat on the tungsten element. But that energy on that the tungsten element is the energy that is stolen from the standing wave. And the amount of energy that is dissipated on that load equals the impedance match percentage to the one-to-one, so it, that could be 20%, 30%, and whatsoever, right or wrong.
Now, you and I have done something similar. We both used in our youth an incandescent light bulb, a 100-watt light bulb, testing a 100-watt transmitter. And hopefully, in those days, we had a real Pi output network on the transmitter where you had a tuning and loading control, and you could force a good impedance match between the transmitter and the light bulb. A light bulb is a very complicated load because when the light bulb is cold, it has one-tenth the resistance of when it's hot. That nichrome wire goes up ridiculously high in resistance when it gets hot. But it is a pure resistive load because the filament wire in that light bulb is much too small at 80 meters and 40 meters and 20 meters. As an antenna to radiate the signal, I don't think it can radiate 1 or 2% of the signal. The signal it gets is all dissipated as heat and light. And how much of it is heat and how much of it is light, that's academic. It's all being absorbed as a very pure dummy load. At certain brilliance of that light bulb, and with the right kind of a antenna tuner or Pi network, you can force it to act like a 50 ohm pure resistive load. Only at a certain power level will it be a resistive load. And you have to readjust the controls of your antenna tuner and so on. So that light bulb can be a pure dummy load, lossy load. Of all the power that the light bulb absorbs, all of it is lost as heat or light. And you and I don't call the light a radio signal, if you know what I mean. So it is not a radio transmitter. You're feeding in a 40 meter signal, 7 megahertz signal. And maybe 1% of it is being radiated into space. And the next door neighbor can hear the signal. But it ain't going to go very far. So the light bulb, of the loss of that light bulb, it's almost pure resistive loss as heat. And that heat has got the light bulb gets hot, and some of that heat happens to be light coming out of it. I'm going to call that heat because that light coming out is not useful to you. Very little of it is at 7 megacycles. The light is at 10 to the 15 hertz, if you know what I mean. So the standing wave ratio you get from a light bulb, you can measure the standing wave ratio. The loss of the light bulb is, for all practical purposes, heat loss. If I had a light bulb set up just right in a black box and had a pure 50-ohm resistor in the second black box, and I did experiments between the two black boxes, until I start feeding a different amount of power, which makes the light bulb bright and dim, and therefore higher and lower impedance, until I change the power, I might not be able to tell which box has got the
repeater. Timeout.
I might.
Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Boy, that's some timeout. You really don't want to hit timeout on this machine. I might not be able to tell which box has got the light bulb, which black box has got the pure 50 ohm resistor. Except for the change in impedance versus the amount of power going into the light bulb, except for that factor, they're both a pure 50 ohm load resistor that takes almost all of the absorbed power and turns it into heat. You could call some of it light, but only a small percentage of it light. I'm going to call that heat because it's not at 7 megacycles, if you know what I mean. Into XJN, K2RIW. There's a lot more to the story, but that gives you some of the info.
Dick, was I forgotten about, and Cleo.
Thank you very much for your time. I do thank you very much for all the answers. I appreciate it. And to achieve.
Yeah, we got to you, Rich, when it comes to your comment, but now we're going to get to your question. N2EO, K2LIW, go ahead with your question, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Dick. More of a comment than a question. Well, first of all, I have a cable here between the amplifier and its output of the radio. There were crimp connectors. The crimp on the amplifier side broke off. A good friend of mine on a new repeater had it made up in his shop. Apparently, the guy that made it up, he crimped the center pin and forgot to crimp the shell. So it was pulled out. Anyway, what I'm replacing it with, Barry's used them, I've used them. We've had very good luck. Radio Shack sells a screw-on connector. No soldering. It cuts a thread on the sensor conductor and on the outside sheath. I've never had trouble with them, and neither has Barry. They've been up to now unavailable. Let me let it drop. Up to now, they've been unavailable because Radio Shack is going out of business. They are available, I found the other day, on the web, radioshack.com. They have the connector for the closeout price, $3 for two. So I bought a bunch of them. They are available from other places for a lot more than $3 for one. So it's a bargain. They have a lot of odd other connectors. For instance, I saw adapters from SO239 to SMA. Check it out. Go on RadioShack.com, put them in the search connectors or anything else. They have a lot of good stuff on closeout, and they ship it. The other thing I want to mention, Dick, I bought that soft start for the amplifier. It's not MFJ, it's made under one of the sister companies, Ameritron. And I told you, the original problem, I'm going to have it solved. You can't control the amplifier from the off-on switch on the amp. You won't get the soft start feature. What you have to do is turn the amp on, but you're not going to get anything, and then turn the soft start on, and it'll give you that soft start where the transformer doesn't vibrate from the inrush current, and the tubes don't light up fast from the inrush current. Anyway, what I'm going to do, I ordered some wood from Home Depot. I'm getting a piece of decorative oak that I'm going to mount on the wall. Barry is going to put it up for me when he comes back in about 2 weeks. I got all the screws, drywall screws, to mount it to the wall. And on that, I'm mounting the soft start with wood screws. It'll bring it a little closer to me. And I bought a 4-foot, 3/8-inch dowel from Home Depot. So I can pick up the dowel and flip the switch with my hand from the wheelchair. I think it'll solve the problem, Dick. Back to net and to wheel.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. That's good information that these screw-on connectors exist. And that's one way of getting a crimp-like connector. And a crimp connector properly installed indoors on a non-critical environment like going between transmitter and antenna tuner and antenna tuner and antenna non-critical indoor environment, no problem. A crimped connector outdoors. Unless you've done a heroic job of weatherproofing the crimp area, you don't want any weather getting into that crimp area, because it's going to give you trouble outdoors. So indoors, I think crimp connectors are usable. And the screw-on connectors indoors, I think they can do a beautiful job. The screw-on connector outdoors, I'm a little worried about it, unless you've done a very good job of weatherproofing the whole end of that cable so that no water gets into those screw threads, which can build up a lot of copper oxide and aluminum oxide and whatever. So that's good to know. And when it comes to the soft start of a power supply for your high-power amplifier, let me drop. How you set up the switches so that you apply the power to the whole circuit and then later apply the power to the soft start, or there's ways of making the soft start work right away, and then as a relay drops out or drops in, there's lots of ways of doing that. You know what you're looking for. So that whenever power is being fed to the power transformer, you want that to be the soft start. Because if Con Ed is at peak voltage at the instant you close that switch, then you're going to get a great big thump on that transformer, because it can't go from zero to full magnetic field in one microsecond, if you know what I mean. And it can't charge your filter capacitors in 1 microsecond. So unless you've got a choke input filter network on the power supply, and very few of us do, we almost all have a capacitive input power supply ripple filter network, capacitor input, you can never change the voltage instantaneously on a capacitor. So therefore, you're going to get some weird, you know, thousands of ampere current flowing that's going to put a thump on all the electric systems in your house, as well as that transformer that makes the sound. So a soft start on a high-power power supply is a very recommended thing. So good luck on that. That's good information that these screw-on connectors exist. Let me drop. The conventional type N connector, for instance, or a conventional PL259 UHF connector, properly installed, can be very reliable. Properly weatherproofed, it can be even very reliable outdoors. I will admit that to properly install a UG21, a type N connector, I'll admit it takes 10 minutes to do the job right. The good news is that you can get 10 years of performance out of it if you install it correctly. The crimp connector saves you a little bit of time when you first put it on. But if you're not going to get 10 years of service out of it, it's false economy, in my opinion. So I'm against crimp connectors outdoors under normal circumstances, unless they've got just the right kind of shrink tubing with goo inside to give you heroic weatherproofing. Those are my opinions. I've seen salt spray tests done under military hardware equipment, where that's the way of really testing the reliability of a connector. And each of the crimp connectors I've ever seen go through a salt spray test, almost none of them survive. They all have some kind of intermittent failure after the salt spray test. What does the salt spray test do? It artificially gives you 10 years of aging on the connector, even though you only run the test for 4 days, if you know what I mean. So it's a useful test to tell you what's going to happen in the future. And crimp connectors almost never pass that test. Thank you for that information. N2EO, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
Okay. Well, the input is a BMC. Steve, WA2ZFC, I consider him a very good friend. He had somebody in the shop make up a piece of, it's not a 58, it's a better cable than that. It's got a silver plated braid, very tight weave braid, covered with an aluminum foil like. He had one of his men make it up. If Steve had made it up, it would have been perfect. The gentleman, whoever it was that made it to Steve, he did not crimp the shield. He crimped the inner conductor, the center. He must have just been... He just forgot. Harmless thing. Anyway, I ordered, it'll be here in a few days, maybe delayed by the holiday, screw-on BMCs. I've used them before. They're very good. They have a lot of other connectors, like SMA to N or SMA to PL259, and a lot of odd other adapters. I know I saw a PL259 to BMC adapter, so I recommend everybody take a look. And if you have something, need something, they got a very good price. It's a closeout price. Back to you, Dick. I'm done. M2EO.
To RVP.
Yeah, thanks for the information. Sounds like RVB. Radio Victor Bravo. Is that who I'm talking to? And give me the prefix and your name. RVB, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW. To Bravo Papa Matt. Mike Alpha Tango. I talked to. I was listening to you in that deck input, but I was commenting. I actually have a crimp on connector in my hand. My 20, it came off. I have to fix it when I get a chance. You know, it's just a crimp one. It works fine. I've been trying to practice to do PL259, the ones that you solder, and I haven't gotten it right. But I'm going to tell you about coax. You were talking about coax and connectors. W2NDR, my dad passed away about 3 years ago, and his station was in coma. My dad had RG8, with the connectors for a CB. It was laying in the booth. It was there for years. It must have been 40 years old. And coax, same, his UHF, and let me drop it, so I'll time it out. Matt, W2NDR, came to my mom. About 2 years ago. It was like Thanksgiving. And the antenna, my dad's antenna was on the ground because a new roof was put on the house and was never put back up. It was an X300. Matt cut the coax. I think the one that he cut the coax. We pulled it through. We needed a lot of coax. Came to my house. He saw the new and we made an adapter to connect both of them. But this coax is, one coax is 40 years old, the other one has got to be like 25 years old. Hooked it up to the, to the X300 antenna, and it works fine. I'm on this right now as I'm talking, using that coax, and it lasted all those years.
Yeah, in the beginning, Matt, your audio was so loud, you were jumping out of the machine. I can tell you're using the Eastern input at Selden 975-375, because I'm hearing you on the input there. That way you're not dropping out, if you know what I mean. So I still haven't heard everything you said in the beginning, but coax, 50-ohm RG8 light coax cable, as long as it hasn't been sitting in a pool of water and corroding, the cable itself, if it's a good brand, that doesn't have a contaminating shield. Some of the poorly made brands used to have a rubber coating on the outside, rubber-like coating, which would somehow migrate into the dielectric material, the polyethylene, and contaminate it, and get some extra loss. On HS frequencies, you usually don't get a hell of a lot of extra loss. When you get extra loss of an old piece of RG8, you're going to get extra loss on, say, 6 meters and 2 meters. The higher frequencies is where the loss really shows up. So the fact that the case is old, if it's good brand, well manufactured, well treated, it doesn't matter if it's 40 years old or 40 years old, Matt. So that's a pleasant surprise you got, that your old piece of cable to your X300 antenna is working so well. Blank number 2 RVB. I'm gonna guess it's a KB2, KN2, something, KA2 RVB. K2RIW, you got it, Matt.
Yes, N2RVP. And the X300 antenna, it's got a fiberglass outside. I guess it's thinning out, but it's working fine. I mean, I've had it up since 2017. I can actually switch over to 8.5. I will get in from 8.5 from here, closer to 3.75. I just bring this up. I can get into Carmel with it. I can get into, I live not far from Port Jefferson, from so I'm not far from the Long Island Sound. So I'll get in. I programmed in a Bridgeport repeater and a New Haven repeater. So I do fine with this. Back to net.
Yeah, some of those coax cables that have fiberglass outside are very high in quality, mil-spec. So that's apparently what you've got there. Good news that your cable has lasted so long. Next person.